This is Going Negative, a podcast about solving climate change through carbon dioxide removal.
Welcome to Going Negative. I'm Tom Green, and today I'm joined by Ross Kenyon from NORI. Welcome to the show, Ross.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Great to speak again. So, Ross, today we're going to be delving into a few issues here. So for our listeners, Ross is a philosopher. He's a podcaster. He runs the NORI podcast about climate. He is the lead strategist of NORI. And is very knowledgeable about all things climate. So excited to have this conversation. To get started, Ross, we'd just love to hear a little bit from you about your personal journey into this space. How did you get involved in climate action?
Well, a philosopher. Tom, you flatter me. I'm really just a goofball. So I don't know that I would accept that, but thank you.
I guess the listeners can decide at the end of the show whether you're a philosopher or not.
No, but they are welcome to decide if they would like. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is sort of my background. I did a year of PhD work in political philosophy, and then decided that wasn't quite the right route for me, but I still wanted to play with ideas. And then, I was working in, film, in cinema, as the enlightened people say, Tom, and was pursuing screenwriting and producing, mostly digital content. And at some point, I was working on a sitcom pilot, actually, with a manager. And then Trump got elected, and the vibe changed around it. It was sort of like Portlandia was a perfect show for the Obama era. But then when Trump got elected, you're like, is Portlandia even tonally the right show anymore? Are progressives willing to laugh at themselves in the same kind of way when progressivism was ascendant in that fashion? So I was working on a script that was of that vibe, and then that happened. So I was like, oh, crap, what do I do? And then I knew people who were involved in the blockchain space, and they needed someone with a comms background to sort of bridge the gap between technologists and the average person. And so I got into that space, and then NORI happened around me because I knew the CEO and my co-founder, Paul Gamble. He was a groomsman at my wedding. We've been friends since our undergraduate years. He tapped me on the shoulder when he was thinking about NORI, and I sort of came into it that way. I didn't have a climate background. I don't even know that I knew very much about environmentalism or climate change prior to NORI. That's one of the things I actually like best about working at NORI is I'm endlessly intellectually stimulated. I'm sure it's the same for you with Vesta. Do you not feel like you're constantly learning and being challenged by physical sciences and also the political ramifications of all of it?
Absolutely. Yeah, no question. So from writing a screenplay into climate change, that's quite the transition. So what was most surprising to you, in what you learned in the first, let's say, 6 months about climate change, and in particular about, I guess, let's call it the zeitgeist around climate change. So how people view it.
Well, let's see. I don't know that I had a lot of faith in people who were working to solve climate change before I started thinking about it very seriously. I think I had a pretty strong adaptationist approach where I was thinking, well, I don't know if these people will be able to stop climate change. Seems unlikely. And if so, then we shouldn't spend a lot of money trying to do things which will fail. We would probably be better off just becoming wealthy. And when you're wealthier, you're able to ride out these changes easier. And that's probably the safest way to go. So if we can, keep the economy going the way that it is for a couple more decades, who knows, maybe you'll have China and India and other countries becoming less impoverished in absolute sense and become better able to adapt to climate change. But I sort of was talked out of that early on, or recognized that carbon removal has a huge role to play, or can have a huge role to play, and that we actually need to be developing this technology now, and hopefully we'll be able to, you know, turn the clock back on the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So that appealed to me a lot more than just something like, let's get cap and trade going, or let's slow emissions, or something like that. I like the finitude of carbon removal, and that was one of the things that attracted me to NORI. And now you can attack me for all the horrible things I just said, Tom.
Well, first I have to look up the meaning of the word finitude, but once I've done that, I'll get started. So, I have to say, I went on a similar journey in a way, was pretty pessimistic about our ability to actually solve or reverse even climate change, and thought of it as more of a sort of how do we adapt. But you know, the more I've got into it, the more I've realized that there are solutions. So I think that's a common theme amongst those of us who turned to working on climate change. One of the things you do in your podcast, the NORI podcast, which by the way I highly recommend listening to, is you've talked to people from a pretty wide range of perspectives, and especially across the political spectrum. So we'd love to hear a little bit about what you've learned there, and especially what you've learned from speaking to folks who are from political persuasions who have perhaps historically been less interested in sort of taking action on climate change, whether it's libertarians or conservatives. Help us understand a little bit sort of what you've learned from your conversations across the political spectrum.
Ooh, no asking of small questions, huh, Tom? there's a lot to say here. Well, my background is I come from a sort of, my political awakening was in the classical liberal libertarian tradition. Over time, I just sort of kept reading and ended up complicating that view. And I'm still quite influenced by a lot of the thinkers that came out of that space, but I'm also influenced by quite a lot of things. And as I get older, I try not to hold too many opinions too tightly that I don't need to hold. So I'm happy playing with ideas and being a little bit more open-ended. And also, it's just more fun and more enjoyable to engage with ideas when you're able to do that, I think. Yeah, there's a lot that I like to do. I like doing episodes with conservative thinkers because there is actually a lot that is very interesting about conservative philosophy and the conservative way of thinking. But mostly what we get from conservatives is what you might call reactionary or populist. Those aren't synonyms, but maybe they're neighbors in some regards. And that isn't the best of what I see in conservatism. When I think about the conservative tradition, I think of someone like Edmund Burke, who is writing from the House of Commons and saying that this French Revolution thing, it's going to go bad. So like right now, it seems like it's a good thing. And the House of Bourbon is not so good. So it's fine to get rid of them. But then what happens after that with the Jacobins and with Robespierre and then ultimately with Napoleon, and then you have Bourbon Restoration. Anyways, Burke ends up calling it and saying, hey, you tried to design society from scratch in your head and to implant this in society and just sort of, you know, impose it there. And it makes sense on paper, but when you do that, you ignore all of the traditions and expectations that grew up around this institution, which, you know, is sort of admittedly corrupt. Like the monarchy is the monarchy as an idea. Sorry, Tom, I know you're loyal to the House of Windsor, so I'll temper my comments a little bit.
please don't do so to avoid the risk of offending me.
Yeah, it's a, the idea of royalty is sort of, I think for most Americans, is inherently offensive, at this aristocratic idea that you'd have peerage in any sort of way like that. But you have to admit that the institution in the UK has actually been it's great to have a head of state that is not also leading your government in some kind of way. It allows like the reverence of the abstract idea of the nation, but also is not the same person that everyone, like half the country hates, you know, and it flips back and forth between which half hates the other there. Okay, I can keep going on this, or it sounds like you want to ask me that, right?
Well, yeah, I'd love to at least make an attempt to bring it back to the conversation around climate. We'll see how that goes, but yeah. So, taking all of what you just said, and taking you know, this idea that there is it's not that there is a lot of merit in some of the you know, traditional forms of government, and you know, and in the roots of conservatism, which you articulated, and talking about, you know, the French Revolution and so on, and bringing that back to what can we learn from that about today's climate crisis, and about the political landscape, how to interpret today's climate crisis through today's political landscape.
Only 3 episodes recorded, and you already know how to reel in an unruly guest. So that is a skill you will need, Tom. Tell you what.
Well, Russ, you're a very fun guest so far. So,
you're totally right. I think, and the conservatives too are also worried about things like the Bolshevik presence in the USSR, and they're worried about this, like, oh, we created a perfect society, and the dangers inherent in that way of thinking. So I think that's a really cool insight, and I think that needs to be present in some of the discussions about climate change, because one of the long-running debates within the climate space is, of course, to what degree can you isolate climate change from other, I don't know, symptoms or problems in society that have been left unaddressed so far. So do you have something like the Green New Deal, which is a chance to remedy quite a lot all at once? Or do you want something much more narrow, keyhole, focused just on parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And So I just gave you a very charitable interpretation of conservative thought, but I don't know that I actually subscribe to it in this case either. I think it's a good caution, but I also read a lot of stuff from other traditions where I think we have some foundational issues in the United States that we might be able to address all at once, and it would be good if we could do so right now. So I think just there's something that's like inherently humbling about that conservative insight in recognizing that there's a limit to how much you can radically transform about our social relations, and to keep that in mind. It might look really good on paper, but also, like, whenever Tom, can I go on like a tiny mini rant on this? Will you allow it?
Rant away, Russ. This is your episode.
There's a really great book on this, actually, I read, called The Fire is Upon Us, which is about William F. Buckley and James Baldwin had a debate, I believe at Cambridge, you know, decades ago. And one of the examples would be, you'd have conservatives who would employ this line of thinking that, you know, like, we have to be careful. You can't just like get rid of society's traditions and structures and expect it all to work out. It leads to chaos and the guillotine and terrible things. And that's why we can't desegregate the South. You're like, what, but that's not the, like that, everything up to that point. And so I oftentimes see this logic deployed in ways where I'm like, this is not correct. I don't support this view. But yeah, so there are good reasons to be suspicious of it as well.
But sort of a flattening of the logic, isn't it? It's sort of saying that, you know, we got rid of one tradition and something bad happened. Therefore, we can't get rid of any other traditions because bad things will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's fun to have conservatives on to talk about this, because those episodes tend to be fairly popular because people they're basically used to Bill O'Reilly or Tucker Carlson yelling at people. And they're not used to, like, a lot of the conservatives I know will be reading, you know, Dante or Virgil or Milton. And I like hanging out with them. I'm like, this is cool. You guys read a lot of the same books and are engaged with the Western canon in an interesting way. But yeah, like anything else, it has your mileage may vary.
Well, I mean, considering Milton, Paradise Lost could be a pretty good way to describe what we're doing to the planet right now.
Man, I've long wanted to do a great books series for like great books and climate. And I have a hard time attracting people to the show to do it. But I always try, Tom. I'm always trying to do a show like that. And one day I will succeed.
Yeah. So, you know, you've talked a little bit about sort of conservatives. And I'd love just to, you know, poke on that a little harder. So what do you think are the sort of strongest arguments that the sort of conservative coalition in the US has at the moment? You know, what is, and if you can summarize, which it's obviously there's a lot of different opinions within conservatism in the US, but if you can summarize kind of what that point of view is right now about what we should or shouldn't do, then I think that would be super interesting.
There's a couple. I think the most relevant is probably, I see this happen a bit more with the American Conservation Coalition and people in that orbit working on the American Climate Contract. Or we've also talked with the economist Brian Kaplan a little bit about this too. But the way of thinking is called keyhole solutions. So like, what's the minimum amount you could change to get this right? So what do you have to change in policy to make it so that climate change is reversed or at least abated in some kind of way? This isn't a chance to fix all of society's wrongs, of which there are a legion. Don't try to do that. There's too many things all at once. It's going to lead to a confusing, gigantic bill that's hard to administer. And there's going to be hands that get in the cookie jar through a legislative process that goes for a long time. And you have to cut deals. And these deals will water down and enrich certain parties at the expense of others, stuff like that. These are arguments that conservatives and libertarians are used to making about policy being complex. And this is the appeal of something like a carbon tax or a fee and dividend program, which is, you know, at least attempting to be much, much simpler than something that is more administered like the Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the case that they would make.
So within that, though, I mean, just to point out an implicit assumption within the comment you just made, that there's an assumption that the broadly the conservative perspective is, yes, we acknowledge at this point that the climate is changing, it's caused by humans, and we really should do something about it if we want to have a planet that's safe and habitable for as many people as possible. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think so. But I was kind of lost in my own thoughts there for a second. will you read it back to me again?
So yeah, I mean, essentially the question is you know, your comments implied that conservatives do believe in climate change and do believe that we need to do something. So would you stand by that statement?
It depends. I think this is anecdotal, so grain of salt, listener. But from what I've seen when I was much younger, I would see a lot more open denial of the science or deep skepticism that climate change is either human caused or as severe as some of the quote-unquote alarmists think it's going to be, stuff like that. I see a lot more stuff that's lukewarmist now, which is more that climate change is real, humans are causing it, but it's not going to be nearly as bad or happen so soon as some of the alarmists think. So I see that a lot more common now, but there are conservatives and libertarians who also take it quite seriously.
Yeah,
it's less common though. You got to dig a little bit for it too. But I don't know, like our CEO Paul has, you know, like pretty outspokenly a libertarian. Like you look at his Twitter if you want. It's possible to care to like free markets and also think climate change is a real problem. I don't know why there's some sort of gap in there. There doesn't need to be a lacuna. No lacuna is necessary.
Right. Well, we're learning so many new words today, Russ. So
sorry.
No, it's all good. So a conservative argument that I've certainly heard a few times is, well, you know, it may well be the case that the climate is changing and that it's going to cause problems, but if we do something to fix it, then we'll lose out economically, and we'll lose out economically to other countries that are in the ascendancy economically, such as China, that may, you know, if they choose to do less about climate change and we choose to do more, it's going to cost us a lot. We're going to lose our competitiveness and become relatively impoverished. How much merit do you think that argument has?
I think it has some degree of merit, but I think it also underestimates the degree to which American leadership is influential on the geopolitical stage. So I think when the United States makes a big move, other countries tend to listen and want to emulate to some extent. So me being an American is clearly on display here, Tom. I don't know. Maybe in the UK, you just like to guffaw at us from across the pond. I don't know. But I think that argument underestimates it and overrates the free rider problem, which is it's a huge problem. And when we think about quite a lot at NORI too. But yeah.
So say more about that. What's the NORI perspective on the free rider problem?
We have to think about it a lot because we're a voluntary carbon removal marketplace. Basically, we rely on people who elect to participate inside of it and to spend money with no guarantee that their neighbors or competitors or other people will do the same. And so this is a classical issue that has long plagued carbon markets, you know, since the beginning, at least the voluntary ones. So NORI focuses right now on regenerative agriculture, which has a number of co-benefits, which if you're listening and you're not familiar with, is the idea that it isn't just the carbon removed that's the benefit. There's also things that tag along. So for farmers, they have increased soil health. They're increasingly resilient in the face of drought or other climate risks and things like that. So there's good reason to do it in addition to merely the carbon benefit. And there's other things too on the corporate front where employees and shareholders are, you know, asking/demanding their companies have really serious climate goals and they stick to them. Amazon was basically forced by an employee uprising/mutiny, whatever you call it, not too long ago to start thinking a lot more seriously about it. Or at least that's my understanding from what I've read about what happened. I don't know the internal politics there very well, but I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And that sort of skirts the line between the classic fight between voluntary or compliance markets.
Right. And you know, if you think about that writ large, then you can also think about political movements, right? You can think about groundswells of, you know, of public support for top-down policies, which will help us to solve this problem. Is that something you see happening?
Yes, I think so. A good like conservative case. I'm not a conservative. I don't identify as such. But I feel like all the things I've said here may leave a lingering impression in someone's mind listening that I am. I just think there's some wisdom there. But I think these like corporate struggles over climate policy. Think of them as like little laboratories. So, you know, if Amazon or Walmart or Microsoft or Salesforce or someone does something, that is very well going to be imitated by VPs of sustainability at other smaller companies and have a watershed effect. And you may see that too with states, like I live in Washington. Washington tries to get certain policies passed, or you live in California. California is super famous for this. They try out things. And I'm really happy that states try out things before it just gets passed at the federal level, because what if it doesn't work that well? Then all 50 states are just stuck with it. I think there's something that's really cool about this flexibility. There are also downsides too, Tom. I'm sure you saw that coming.
Yeah, well, and first of all, thanks for clarifying where you are on the political spectrum. So Tucker, if you're listening, then Ross is not a full supporter.
I'm some sort of, I don't even know how I would identify. I just like to read books and try to be fair to everyone. I think that's probably the thing that I'm worst about, though, is I probably am more fair than I should be at points. But yeah, it's out of fashion these days to do it that way. But
yeah, absolutely. So let's just talk about, you mentioned a little bit about NORI, where you're the lead strategist and what you guys do, enabling people to buy carbon credits in a sort of a marketplace model, right? Can you say a little bit more about NORI's vision?
Yeah, NORI is a carbon removal marketplace, as I've mentioned. We want to make it as easy as possible for people to pay for and get paid for carbon removal. And we've started with regenerative agriculture. So farmers can change their practices and actually stop emitting nearly so much and actually be pulling CO2 into their soil, which is very neat and a good thing to do for a number of reasons. Ultimately, we're agnostic. We want to be supportive of the entire carbon removal ecosystem, as long as it's ethical and credible that what you say is happening is actually happening. So for that reason, we're excited about mineralization efforts like you're involved with, and direct air capture of all varieties is something that we track pretty closely. Blue carbon stuff happening in aquatic environments is fascinating. So we'd like to expand to that and a whole bunch of other things. But right now, like a startup, you have to be pretty focused. It's hard to do even one thing competently, let alone excel at it. So we're quite focused just on agriculture in the US right now, but that won't always be the case.
Right, right. Well, that sounds like a smart strategy. And, you know, recent news, David Beerling's paper in Nature about soil, carbon capture through soil through mineralization. So that was obviously, you know, big recent news in the agricultural carbon capture space.
Yeah, that was the hybrid, the combo, the spreading a rock on croplands, that paper.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we covered that in a podcast recently. I thought that was super interesting, and I can't wait for more and more things like that to happen as people get creative and there's monetization available and research being funded both by the government and other places. I'm sure we're going to see a lot more creative uses like that. I'm sure you'll see a bunch more with what you're doing at Vesta as well.
Yeah, and also the soil circles brings us back to this point around the economy and, you know, ways to address climate change that don't harm the economy, right? If you're improving the soil, then, you know, and you're improving crop yields, then you're actually making life economically better for farmers, which, you know, and as many listeners I'm sure know, there's been serious problems with the worsening of soil quality in this country. So, you know, that as one example, or if you are or if you're doing something else that has co-benefits, as you mentioned, such as, you know, what we do at Project Vesta, which not only captures carbon dioxide but also makes the ocean less acidic, which might improve fishery yields and so on. So all of these are things that that could actually boost the economy at the same time as removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and helping to reverse climate change.
I think that's right. I think people oftentimes think as climate mitigation or carbon removal practices as being a zero sum with the economy. And in some cases, they very well might be. And if you zoom in far enough, then yeah, there will be winners and losers. And some producers of various types of fossil fuels are no longer going to have a social license to operate, or it's going to be extremely curtailed, et cetera. But I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for new types of entrepreneurship. Nori's vision, or at least part of it, is if we could have a credible, universal, market-driven price on carbon removal, how many new companies and nonprofits and smart people would join the carbon removal space in order to develop faster, cheaper, better methods of carbon removal. And I think that's really what we're hoping for, is that there's a whole bunch more brain power that joins this space. And that's a lot of what we do with our communications too, is we want to attract people to this sector. We want more people to be thinking about this. So, and I imagine that's at least partly what you're trying to do too.
Absolutely, yeah. So if you're a smart, ambitious young person, consider getting into climate change, because, you know, I think certainly from my point of view, and perhaps from yours as well, Ross, there are very few, perhaps no things more important that one could be working on than helping to secure a habitable future for the planet.
Totally. And it's, as we said at the beginning, it's intellectually stimulating, like a few other things is. The podcast that we do is so broad, and I imagine yours could be as well, just because you can make basically anything about climate change if you dig hard enough, if you if you dream deep enough, you can make a podcast with a tenuous link to climate that your colleagues will tolerate.
Well, on that note, Russ, it's been an absolute delight speaking with you. Such a pleasure. So just want to really thank you so much for coming on the show, and hope to do it again.
Thanks. It's very weird to be on the other side of it. I backled you a number of times, asking you questions, steering the conversation in inappropriate ways. Thanks for having me, Tom. I'm happy. People often ask me too about if they should start a climate podcast. And my first instinct is to tell them, no, climate change podcasting is full. We've got it under control. Don't worry about it. I never said that. We need all of it that we can get. We need more people talking about it and doing it. And I'm happy you've joined the fray and stuck your hat into the ring here to mix up a bunch of metaphors. So thank you, Tom.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Russ. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Going Negative, a podcast about solving climate change through carbon dioxide removal. If you enjoyed it, please share it with your friends. We hope you'll join us next time. Until then, take care.